I'm Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians, and those of you who listen to the radio because it feels like thinking. Good morning to you people. Good morning to you, Mark Riley.
Good morning to you, Mark Maron.
Here we go again, man. Here we go again.
Wednesday.
I tell you.
Hump day.
Oh, dude. I got the little scratch that Gilman had yesterday. Wayne Gilman, our news guy, for those of you who don't know, you don't get Wayne Gilman. Does everybody get Wayne Gilman? Most people do. No, some people don't.
Some people don't.
Yes, he's our New York news guy.
I don't get
out
Wayne Gilman.
Out today with the frog in his throat. You don't get him either. Yeah, he's kind of a complicated character.
He is a complicated man.
I took it. Now, Caleb, did you talk to me yesterday about wanting to double the bet? Because I took a step in my vegetarianism yesterday that I find disturbing and my wife found disturbing as well.
Yeah, I'm going to double the bet. Double or nothing. $40 says that you can't last a month without eating meat.
Well, you know what? I'm going to tell you exactly what happened yesterday, and it's going to make you sad you just made that bet in front of God and everybody.
Oh, God. What? All
right. I went into the Sai Baba health food store around the corner from my house. I don't know if I'm moving more towards vegetarianism or I might end up a Sai Baba adept or whatever you call them, a follower. You know, because the guy's being awfully nice to me, and, you know, like, I've spent a lot of time trying to irritate these people because they seem so nice. They're hard to irritate. But now I find myself, you know.
They're hard to irritate.
Yes.
I guess you know.
Yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. I'm very good at irritating people. Ask this one particular unemployed insomniac in the Bay Area who calls us every day to report on my narcissism. Someday, we're going to get her on the air, man.
Good morning to you.
Yeah, I have one obsessive fan. She obsessively hates me, but yet writes down everything I say because she's completely fascinated with me and secretly in love with me. Okay, and I will say, I am going to say that right now, and that's okay. It's okay for her to be that way. But here's what I'm going to say. This will make her happy because I'm going to indulge myself. I went in there to the Sai Baba health food store. It's not called that, so it's just that's the cult, the sect. Not cult, the sect of Hinduism. Is he Hindu, I believe? Perhaps Buddhist? Maybe I should research it if I'm going to be assumed to be a follower. He's an Indian guy that wears nice flowing robes, and he's usually got a big fro. Right there, right away, you look at the guy, you're like, that guy looks cool, because he's got the big 60s style fro. You know what I mean? And but he has been accused of some, you know, nasty stuff. Yeah, you know, standard sect leader, kid stuff, you know. But it has been proven. I read it in Salon.com. But let's not get into that, because I don't want to piss off the Sai Baba people. What I was getting at, Kalo, went in there yesterday, hey, fish store's closed. Don't want meat. Don't not go in the butcher. Butcher's open. Wow, never tried a soy cutlet.
Oh,
I made the jump to soy cutlet, my friend. Bought myself some soy cutlets. Cooked them up with some quinoa. So I had some quinoa, a soy cutlet, and some kale, my friend. I'm in it, dude. I'm in it. You can't win now.
So you like that awfulness?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. What I'm saying is I've made a commitment, and you can't do it. I call my wife on the... I'll tell you, it's amazing to live in the modern world where I got a guy who used to live in Moscow driving my car. I'm on a cell phone talking to my wife who's reading me Edna St. Millay poems. All right? Where do you get that? That's like space travel. If you were going to say that to somebody, that you'd be talking on a communicator with somebody in California that has not connected to a cord, being driven by a guy who was once a member of the Soviet bloc, having Edna St. Millay poems read to you by a beautiful woman 2,000 miles away. What? We live in the future, my friend. But when I told her what I did with the soy cutlet, you know what she did? She called me a hippie. That's what she said. She said that's hippie stuff. You know what I mean? Because she grew up with hippies.
She's right.
She knows.
She said to me, I know when I met you, you were wearing patchouli, but I thought you had some camp. There was some distance from it. It was sort of a detached, ironic patchouli wearers. But she says, I think you got some hippie in you.
Well, that's good. So now you remind her of her parents.
Yeah, which is bad. I mean, it's kind of bad because she has complete resentment for the amount of soy she had to withstand as a kid. All right? You should see these pictures of her when she was a baby being held by these people that look like they're in the Manson family. All right? But I love them now. They've grown up. They were younger then. But her dad had this Manson beard and his long black hair, and her mom was all sunshiny. But they're great now. Diane, John, good people. Everybody's good. I want to thank. Yeah, it's weird when you get into the. Like, I'm all of a sudden like, oh, I just stepped in a hole here, didn't I? Because they're listeners, and I love them. They're my in-laws. talk to my father, but we're not going to get into that because I'm going to save that for later because I want to make sure my obsessive fan in the Bay Area is up before I start talking about myself too in depth.
Oh, trust me, she's up.
Now, do want to say thank you to Tanya and Raph in New York. They live here in New York. Yesterday, I get in the mail, Riley saw it.
Yeah.
Big Trader Joe's TJ's bag full of cat food. Got a little picture of their cats because I talked about missing TJ's, and they said there's plenty in Westchester. I can come over for dinner. Here's some cat food for your kitties. And I brought it home, and I'll feed it to them later. Now,
oh, you didn't give it to them?
Well, I forgot to this morning. This cat's gotten the habit of waking me up, and it's unnerving because I can't connect with this cat. There's one that I just...
Oh, that's the one? Still the one?
Yeah, just I can't connect with the cat. I tried to. I used all the different voices. I had that book that the fan of the show yesterday sent to, you know, her name's Lynn, I think, sent me that book, and I'm reading the hippie book on cats, and I'm eating my soy cutlets, and I'm sitting there talking to my cat. I'm turning into a... I am turning into, like, a strange...
crazy person.
No. That wasn't the wording I was going to use. I'll pull out of it, man. And maybe it's just a phase. You know what else is sad? Now this is going to blow your mind, and if you care about me, which a lot of people do, some not so much. And some people enjoy the Marc Maron. I think Splenda's out, dude. I got it.
Wow.
Everything's changing, man.
One article?
Everything.
End of Splenda?
One article that referred to organ swelling, but the wrong organ. Do you dig what I'm saying, man? No, I'm talking about kidney swellage. They haven't done a lot of the reports on it yet, but when I started talking about Splenda and defending, because I have to admit, I love this stuff. Love it. I think it's the best non-dairy or whatever it is, the best sweetener that's come out in years. But, of course, they haven't done a lot of tests. The tests they have done has caused some kidney swellage. And I'm at this point in my life where I think about anything that's going on inside of me with any sort of, you know, pain at all, I get completely disturbed, and it bothers me.
So that's right. The end of the Splenda. Back to sugar?
I doubt it.
Back to sweet and low?
I think I'm just going
to
go without it. I think, what do I need it for? It's not doing anything but making it taste better. You know what I mean? If it was giving me a little jack, it would be different. You know what I mean?
So you're talking about now just, in other words, tea with no sugar at all, no sweetener at all.
Yeah, just tea with milk. That's no problem. You know what I mean? I mean, I wasn't getting the jack out of it anyways. I mean, I'd eat sugar, but then, you know, you're going to have to deal with me on sugar. You know, I mean, you can barely, how can you deal with me? Remember the beginning of this party that we started when I was eating a pack of M&Ms and drinking a cup of Dunkin' Donuts coffee, blasting away, sweating, freaking people out, having brain skids, not knowing whether, I mean, literally, you know, Clutch Larson, you know, was going to quit because I made him cry so many times. He doesn't cry.
I know he doesn't cry. But the other thing is, you know, you don't do that. You don't do the M&Ms. You don't do the big
and
rush.
And isn't it a nicer place to work
now? I
know,
but all you got to do is one teaspoon of turbinado sugar. Oh, that's all you need, man. Too much.
I thought you, of all people, would know the disposition of the dope fiend.
I understand the disposition, but listen, I understand only too well. Yeah. That's why I'm saying just one teaspoonful of turbinado sugar, and you're fine.
All right. Larson has come in.
Uh-oh.
He's standing at the microphone, which is weird. It's just only happened maybe twice.
What? Sometimes I cry.
At home, not in front of me. He wouldn't give me the pleasure of that. No, that's Clutch Larson. Let's come back. We're going to talk to Riley. Let's get into this guy that's going to be the prime minister, possibly. Looking like the dude, Ibrahim al-Jafari, a member of the Dawa Party in Iraq. Things are changing. We don't know how still. We don't know what's going to happen. We're going to try and figure it out when we come back. It's 14 past the hour. It's Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition,
the highest rated, most respected news show in America.
On Air America Radio.
Feels good to be a gangster.
Yes, it does feel good. 19 past the hour, Marc Maron. It's Mark Riley. You're listening to Morning Sedition.
Yes, you are.
We are about to talk about some stuff, some Iraq stuff. But I would like to preface this all by saying that, you know, the president has asked for $82 billion, more dollars, emergency dollars, outside of the budget dollars,
you know, sort of putting it under the umbrella of an emergency so he didn't have to put it into the budget, which is already excessive, and cutting everything so he could service the neocon death cult's, you know, reverse money laundering scheme by running, you know, decent taxpayer money through the war into the pockets of price-gouging military contractors like Kellogg Brown Root, Bechtel, Parsons Group, Shaw Group, Halliburton, and the likes. So it's important that we report on what is happening there with this, you know, this occupation that seems never ending. And now, after so many reasons for the war have changed and lies have sort of justified this war to the people that believe in this administration, we are now seeing a government take form. And the guy who is set to become the prime minister, it seems, is this fellow Ibrahim al-Jafari. He apparently was one of the leading opposition party people under Saddam. He was thrown out of the country or left in 1980 and was one of the first to get back. You know, Riley, we forget that there was a bunch of these guys, these Iraqi exiles, these guys who were in government or fought Saddam early on, that have just been waiting.
Oh, yeah.
Waiting. For their turn to get back, you know, and this guy, who is he?
Okay, it's interesting you say that people have been waiting to get back, because that was exactly what happened in Iran in the late 70s, when the Ayatollah Khomeini, who had been living in London for years, and it's interesting because the common point is Jafari himself had been living in London until Saddam fell. It seems like London is kind of a haven for Mideast opposition, depending on what the circumstances
are. When Khomeini was living in London, though, he was still Khomeini. He still, you know,
he was still
here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Now, it's interesting because al-Jafari is a family doctor.
Right.
He is not, in the strictest sense of the term, a cleric. Okay. He fled a crackdown by Saddam back in 1980, and he is talking now, and it's interesting, he spoke to the Associated Press the other day and said that he's looking for a moderate kind of balance between secularism and Islam, both in the Iraqi constitution and in the way that the country is governed.
Now, the Dawa Party is one of the two religious parties within this new Shia slate, right? The 48,
yes.
At least 48% of the assembly is going to be this this United Iraqi Alliance.
Yes.
Half of which is this party where that this guy comes from or represents.
The Dawa Party. Now,
right.
This is what's interesting about how Jafari is treading water here.
Hmm.
The Dawa Party does call for an Islamist state under Sharia law, which is not exactly what al-Jafari is saying. He's essentially saying he has concerns for women's rights, he has concerns for all kinds of things that would run contrary to Islamic law. And when asked about that apparent contradiction, he says, and I'm quoting here,
okay,
theory is different from practice.
Well, he's one of these guys that says, the way he does it, the way he parses his language, he says, I believe in Islamic law, but I believe that we shouldn't take the Quran for what it says necessarily in terms of reality, right? He's not like, he wouldn't be one of these guys that, you know, believes the Bible is fact. He says we have to look at, you know, what laws and what practices are within it that we can apply without, you know, being extreme. I think it's his way of being sort of diplomatic. He seems to want to appease who's ever in power. But just by this quote about women, he said, quote, a man is worth two women. But added, then he said, quote, we have to be careful about taking verses in isolation. But a man is worth two women. I mean, if we're going to, you know, really sort of draw up the math. So, I mean, it's not clear how you know, is this guy
he's
really
treading water. He's
exactly
treading a very fine line here. He is a Shia. He doesn't want to appear to be too secular because Shalabi, who is a secular Shiite, is still in contention here. And, in fact, if the Kurds say that they don't want al-Jafari, Shalabi could still pull this thing off. Now, he represents the secular wing of Iraqi politics. The fact that Jafari represents the Dawas means that you're looking at a more religious-based state than you would under Shalabi. And Shalabi doesn't, quite frankly, seem to have a great number of constituents among these folks that are going to make this final decision.
Well, is this guy, al-Jafari, is he sort of like Bush is to the Christian right? Somebody who is going to, you know, present a religious face, but be able to, you know, present themselves as you know, appealing to people that aren't of religious faith? Is he one of these kind of people that's going to work both sides but really believe a certain way?
Well, that is what he's trying to do.
Hmm.
Remember that during the course of the American occupation, on several different occasions, he pushed the Americans away, but yet he still served as a vice president in this transition government that's going to go out now that this election is final. So he has, in the past, kind of played both ends against the middle if you look at it from an American point of view. But the fact is that the guy now is saying that he doesn't think American troops should leave Iraq. Which is, again, when you say on the one hand he opposed the invasion, but now he says the troops shouldn't leave. How do you reconcile that? Easily. He knows the American troops have to be there in order for him to govern as prime minister should he get the job.
Right. And in order for there, you know, he's also watching his back in terms of managing a civil war that is sure to unleash if the Americans left, because now there's word coming out that, you know, the numbers of Iraqi, you know, forces that have been trained or effective in combat is even less than that they've been saying, and that they're no longer going to release numbers. So now it's like, you know, of course he's going to say that now. He's like, they better stay here if we want to get this government operational and implement enough rules and laws and order into the country that we won't be taken down in a matter of months by whatever the opposition is, how that manifests itself.
The big challenge for anyone governing Iraq, whether it's Chalabi, al-Jafari, or whoever, is how to deal with this insurgency. Remember that in Egypt, they had a similar kind of insurgency, and Hosni Mubarak came down on these people like crazy. That's why so many of them have been dispersed and ended up in Iraq.
Well, that's why he's saying we got to keep the Americans here, because he knows that whatever national security forces have been trained is not going to be enough.
No, it's not going to be enough, but also it keeps the Iraqis off the fight. In other words, it's not Jafari that's coming down on the insurgency like this, assuming that there are some rights violations. Because, you know, there have been numerous allegations that Hosni Mubarak has, you know, wholesale violated rights in the crackdown in Egypt. And if they have that kind of Egyptian-style crackdown, it's going to be very interesting to see what the role of the Americans will be in all of this.
Well, I think the fear is really still a theocratic sort of Islamo-fascist state, because this guy is, you know, he's sort of like the, you know, he wears pinstripe suits. He looks urbane. He, you know, he's sophisticated. He's lived in London. But let's not forget that he is going to be on the puppet strings of Ayatollahs. Am I right?
Well, he's certainly going to have a better relationship with him than most Iraqi governments have had in the past. And there's going to be a border closure in Iraq coming up soon. Actually, coming up Thursday, it's going to be interesting to see, too. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk more about this. We're going to talk about Bush and POWs and a whole lot more here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
What is this f***ing ponderous, man? Ponderous. F***ing ponderous.
Yeah, so we're getting into it here on Morning Sedition. We are getting into what is, you know, sort of settling in as the government in Iraq. We're talking about Ibrahim al-Jafari, who is who is the head of the Dawah Party, the Dawah Party is the one of two of the leading religious parties in the United Iraqi Alliance. The other is
the Skiris.
The Skiris.
That's the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution.
All right, let me do this real quick. This came in from Ramon, who was wearing leather chaps. Okay, today we somehow or another got hold of Jeff Gannon, a.k.a. James Guckert, a.k.a. the bogus reporter who managed to get a White House press pass. So here's his palm pilot for today. 7 a.m., wake up, choose name. Career, job history, underwear. 9 a.m., delete bookmarks for these websites. HotMilitaryStud.com and MilitaryEscorts.com. Launch new websites, HotFakeReporter.com and HotSoftballs.com. 11 a.m., photo session, pose in front of Bill of Rights wearing powdered wig and underwear. Oh, nice. 12:30 p.m., meet White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan for drinks and whatever. 1:30 p.m. Place personal ad. Quote, seeking men who have divorced themselves from reality or are just divorced. End quote. 4 p.m. Call Republican power brokers in Texas. See if there's anyone else they'd like me to be. Oh, he's a sad man with a hole in him. 6 p.m. To make sure the words Jeff Gannon are never mentioned on Fox News, offer their executives the usual drinks and whatever. All right, so let's talk about this. What is it? How do you pronounce the name of the other party now? Again, there, Riley.
It's SCIRI.
SCIRI. And this is
Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution.
Now that sounds a little hairy.
Iraq.
Sounds a little hairy to me, man. So we got the Dawah Party and the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq.
Yeah.
These are the two religious parties that are within the United Iraqi Alliance, which won at least 48%.
Of the vote.
So they are, you know, almost a majority.
Something on the order of 140 seats in the National Assembly they will control. Now, both Dawah and the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq spent a good deal of time when Saddam Hussein was in power in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
So that they do have a decent relationship. And remember, they're both Shia as well. So they do have a very good relationship with the Ayatollahs who run Iran. That doesn't mean they necessarily want to set up a theocracy inside Iraq, but they do have direct ties to the Iranians. What's interesting about this, Mark, is that you see this kind of horse trading, which is a staple of American politics. SCIRI had a candidate that they had running, that they wanted to be prime minister. He was the finance minister, Abdel Abdul Mahdi.
Mm-hmm.
And the Abdel Aziz Al Hakim, who we mentioned yesterday, who's the head of SCIRI, pulled this guy out, and which really kind of paved the way for Al-Jafari to be the leading candidate.
I think also what is interesting and is never going to not be interesting is that the neocon death cult's plans have on some level blown up in their face. I mean, I don't think they ever anticipated democracy or an election working this well in terms of, you know, presenting them with a government that is completely contrary to what they had intended there, which was basically a free market utopian experiment. Now they got to figure out how to not only occupy the country continually, but, you know, make these guys sellouts, which their politicians, I imagine, won't be that difficult.
See, here's the problem confronting any Iraqi government.
Hmm.
Iraq is rich with oil, as we all know.
Right.
Iraq also has no infrastructure, which we all know. Logic would dictate that money from the oil would go directly into rebuilding the infrastructure. And by the way, you don't need Americans to do any of this.
Mm-hmm.
The Iraqis could do it themselves. Assuming they had an army and a police force that could keep people secure, the Iraqis could rebuild their own infrastructure without any help from the Americans.
Easily.
But that would, of course, deprive American corporations of big money. So it's not going to happen.
So how do they navigate all this stuff, Riley?
Well, how they navigate it is by making sure, first of all, the Iraqis are navigating it, I think, very cleverly. Now the missing piece in the puzzle are the Kurds. The Kurds have got their guy, Jalal Talabani, who we spoke about yesterday. They want him to be the president. In order to get the backing from the Kurds to make Jafari the prime minister, they're going to want their guy as president. That means that what you're going to end up having, and this is where the problem is going to come with the Shiites,
yeah,
you're going to end up having, almost by definition, some form of federalism, because the Kurds are going to have their own independent, not their own independent state, but certainly their own autonomous state, which is the definition of federalism. They're going to be able to make their own laws, in many cases levy their own taxes. They've got their own militia, and they're not giving any of that up. The Turks may not be happy about it, but they're not giving it up. That means you've got a federalist government, which by definition means that you don't have the law coming only from the top, only from the head of the state, only from, even in theory, the theocracy.
So theoretically, if the Sharia gets a little too intense for you in the Shia section, you could move to the Kurdish section, or Kurdistan, if that's what they're going to
call
it.
Well, no, they're not going to call it Kurdistan. The Turks wouldn't. They have something a little bit to say about that.
So wait, let me just get this straight, Riley. So on some level, the free market experiment could actually pan out for the neocon death cult. That now that they have this reverse money laundering scheme with the war, they're funneling, you know, our money, taxpayers' money and the money that they borrow from China or wherever through this war into the pockets of military contractors once they set up shop with this government that that comes into power and, you know, and outbids, you know, whatever other corporate entities in the world outside of American companies or whatever companies are in cahoots with our government, they will probably get those contracts.
They'll get the contracts, but here's the kicker, Mark. The problem is that all of these folks in the United Iraqi Alliance, they know that in order to be able to govern the Iraqi people, they have to be able to provide jobs for people. They can't depend on American military contractors to guarantee jobs for Iraqis. That's their job to do.
But can they guarantee jobs for Iraqis in American corporate plants that are being built in Iraq?
Well, they're going to have to. And they're going to have to, little by little, start pushing those corporations out of Iraq. Because they are, along with the military, symbols of American occupation that Iraqis deeply resent. Whether they, you know, want to be safe or not, they still resent the idea that these are Americans getting rich. These are American corporations doing this. And when Iraqis have a 50 to 70% unemployment rate among Iraqi men, that is unacceptable. The government coming in knows that. In addition to drafting a constitution, in addition to keeping all of these different forces, you know, off of each other's throats, they have to be able to provide something of substance for the Iraqi people, and they can't do that in concert with the Americans.
Well, it's very interesting to me because, you know, you have this sort of multifaceted, multi-faced insurgency. You know, some of them are jihadists, some of them are Ba'athists, some of them are you know, rebels in the face of complete destitution. You know, people who are just angry. Now, in terms of a Muslim government or the unfolding of a moderate theocracy, is that going to quell any of the jihadists' intentions in terms of their desires and make the struggle on behalf of the insurgency actually, you know, more political and less just sort of murderous religious fanaticism?
Probably not. I think the jihadists will remain murderous religious fanatics.
Yeah.
I think that's what their game is, and I'm not sure you could put any government. I'm just, you know, again, this is just opinion here.
Sure.
But I don't think you could put any government in Iraq that would satisfy the jihadists at this point.
Yeah.
The question is, how repressive will the government be in trying to end the insurgency? That's what the Egyptians had to confront. There have been many different governments in the Middle East that have had to confront insurgencies, on-the-ground insurgencies, and the question is, how repressive do you get?
And how are they, you know, what is the American, you know, presence there going to, you know, how are they going to engage in that? And is this going to be the first big test of this new, you know, Iraqi National Security Force? Is basically what you're saying. Are they going to rise to that occasion? Are we going to get out of there? Are we going to stop funneling, you know, billions and billions and billions of dollars, you know, in the, you know, from this, you know, fiscally irresponsible administration into a never-ending war that only, you know, benefits price gouging military contractors, and you know,
that's what it is too. Price gouging,
yeah,
serious price gouging.
And are we going to funnel some of that money back here? This is a government that is not even willing to allow some of that money from Iraq that they have frozen, some of Saddam Hussein's money that has been awarded a group of POWs, American POWs that were held in Iraq during the Gulf War, and tortured in Abu Ghraib. All right, and they were, you know, given, you know, awarded through an American court, you know, vis-a-vis the Geneva Convention rules, you know, awarded, you know, a multi-million-dollar settlement that the Bush administration is now saying, well, those were different Iraqis. These are the Iraqis that are in power now. This is heinous. You know, they came just short of calling it a frivolous lawsuit.
Yeah,
we will talk about this when we come back. It's 44 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Mike Mills from REM, and you are listening to Mark and Mark on Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Oh, there's the fax machine with the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Please write these down. These are important. These are your marching orders for today, liberal soldiers. One, read Jose Canseco's book. Then, regardless of your profession, enhance your performance with steroids. Two, language change. Refer to being picked up by a gay prostitute as being Gannonized or Gannoned or on the Gan. Three, point to the fact that the NHL hockey season may be canceled as a victory for the peace movement. Four, go to Michael Jackson trial, gather all his celebrity character witness together, and have a MoveOn.org fundraiser. There you go. Five, today's phrase is drop it into conversation. Oh, yeah, Bush is right. Congress should definitely renew the Patriot Act. Got to keep our kids safe from books, man. Wake up, sheeple. Bush is coming at you with a taser. Come on. Don't drink the Kool-Aid. So, dude, this is heinous. You know, also, stay tuned. We're going to have our first ever ticket giveaway. Later in the show, we'll be giving away a pair of tickets to me, my sold-out show tomorrow night at Symphony Space. That's coming up later in the show. Also, if you want to email us, you can go to sedition@airamerica.com, airamericaradio.com. You can blog at morningsedition.com. You can also buy T-shirts and books and anything. You know, there's a lot of stuff there at morningsedition.com. Now let's get into this, Riley. This is all very very disturbing. Outside of the fact that George W. Bush and the neocon death cult have asked for axed. What am I from Brooklyn? Have asked.
No.
Well, what's the matter?
No, you had it right the first time. They've been doing some axing too.
Oh yes, axing and asking for $82 billion, right? $82 billion. An emergency war funding, which, you know, has come out under fire because they're doing that outside of the budget, where it doesn't seem like it's an emergency. It just seems like them to make it look like their budget isn't as heinously big as it already is. They don't want to make it bigger. Am I right in that?
Yes.
Okay, so now moving on from that is that along with that budget cutting, they are cutting, treatment for veterans, all right? The requirement, the copay for prescription drugs. And there's going to be a new fee of $250 a year for the privilege of using government health care. The prescription drugs for veterans is going up two times as much as it was. All right. And now, you know, what you have is that there's all kinds of horrendous cuts, you know, being done here in the States because of this this war effort and this reverse money laundering scheme to, you know, funnel money from the taxpayers and from government loans into military contracting. So now you have all of these people. You have people like Kellogg Brown and Root. You have people like Parsons Corporation, Fluor Corporation. These people, Kellogg Brown and Root, $11.431 billion has already been paid to them. All right? Parsons Corporation, $5.286 billion. Fluor Corporation, $3.75 billion. Donald Rumsfeld, you know, even said that the people that we tortured in Abu Ghraib deserve some compensation for what we put them through. Yet this administration, the neocon death cult, not willing to give soldiers of our own military who were tortured in Abu Ghraib by Iraqis under Saddam Hussein in the Gulf War the compensation they deserve.
In 1991, a group of American pilots were beaten and abused. There is no question about that, by the way. And they were beaten and abused in Abu Ghraib. And the Bush administration is using the flimsiest of pretexts for trying to say these prisoners of war, former prisoners of war, people, for example, that have something in common with Senator John McCain, himself a former prisoner of war, that these people should not be able to collect nearly $1 billion from Iraq. That's how much they won in a judgment. Federal judge awarded them that as compensation for their torture.
Yeah.
And now the Bush administration is saying, and by the way, part of what these people won is covered by the Geneva Convention. The Geneva Convention says that states will never absolve another state of any liability for the torture of POWs. Now, you would think, Mark, you see that in the Geneva Conventions, that would fit these POWs. Not according to the Bush administration, they don't.
Well, this is the horrible thing is that the amount of money that they must have frozen from Saddam's regime, the amount of money of oil money, you know, for God's sakes, there's $8.8 billion missing.
That's for Iraqi oil revenue. But you know what? The people that you just ran, the Kellogg Brown and Roots, the Parsons, the Fluor, you know how much that is total?
How much?
Now, this is post-war contracts from 2002 through July of 2004. The total, $47.549 billion.
That's unbelievable.
And not a billion for war heroes.
Yeah, and how many guys is that? There's like 17 guys who are involved in this. There's a, you know, it's like...
Are you talking about the numbers of
the POWs?
Yes. 17 POWs, 17 U.S. contractors who get a billion or more out of Iraq.
And it's just unbelievable to me that, you know, is this part of their tort reform? Is this part of their restricting victims' rights? Is to, you know restrict the rights of our POWs, of these guys who were, you know, let me tell you some of the stuff they went through. They were held in basement cells at the Iraqi secret police headquarters. Some of them were beaten into a loss of consciousness, causing broken noses, fractured skulls. Some of them were urinated upon. They did a form of electric shock torture on these guys with a device that they called the Talkman that was wired around their head. They were starved. They had ruptured eardrums. The thing is, it doesn't matter the details. The truth of the matter is that this isn't even money that's coming from the government. These guys are so damn greedy that they can't even, you know, allow justice to happen in a case where the victims are our own military personnel in something that is not in dispute what happened to these guys. The Bush neocon death cult, Cheney's neocon death cult, are just pulling a loophole on these guys. They're saying, no, that money, no, these are good Iraqis now. I don't know what happened to that money. Maybe we could ask Saddam. I mean, I don't know. We'll try and see if we have time. I mean, these guys are evil bastards, and they're robbing the country. And this is just a very effective metaphor of how little they give a crap about anything but themselves.
They will rob, and they will ignore even their friends. The people who are kicking the loudest about what you mentioned earlier, the cut in some of the benefits that veterans are getting. And by the way, there's not a dime for veterans, according to Patty Murray, senator from Washington State. Not a dime in that $81.9 billion supplemental budget request. None of it goes to veterans. The American Legion, the VFW, the Rock Rib Americans that formed the spine of George W. Bush's support are screaming like bloody murder about what he's doing to veterans. What does that tell you?
What they're doing is cutting and running here on domestic policy and on treating this country's people properly. They're saying that this money that they're denying these guys in a just settlement is going into the rebuilding of Iraq. So what are these guys supposed to do? Thank them? Are they going to say that, are they going to sign language to the guy whose eardrums are ruptured, the money's going to Iraq, you should be happy because, you were fighting for that. And the guy's going, you know what I mean? You see, the thing is that it's a heinous transgression on behalf of this administration. It just shows how callous and irresponsible they are with the American people's money, the American people's feelings, and just how duplicitous and full of lies they are.
You want to hear how full of lies they are? We're going to tell you on the other side of this break. We're going to have it from the horse's mouth of the Bush administration, exactly what they have in mind.
And twisting,
yeah,
twisting.
Twisting, leaving veterans twisting in the wind when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Good morning. We're back. It's 6 past the hour on Morning Sedition. This is Air America Radio. I am Mark Maron. That is Mark Riley. How are you, sir?
How are you, sir?
It is Wednesday morning. I am fine. I am fine. I am living my life, Mark Riley.
There you go. This
is the life that I live. You know what I mean? There's a weird argument that goes on in my head on a daily basis is that, and it's an argument that apparently some of our listeners have with themselves as well. Clearly, the woman in out there in the Bay Area who calls herself the unemployed...
Insomnia.
Or I think she says self-employed, but
By the way, How are you?
A fine line, And she has a problem with the amount of male energy that travels throughout the little wires around the studio. She has a problem with the amount of time that I spend talking about myself, which is something I've done my entire career. And it's an interesting thing, just, I always wonder about people who never talk about themselves. I don't, you know, I know, you know, some people will talk about themselves too much. Maybe I do, but it's my prerogative. It's my choice. This is my show. This is our show. You're free to talk about yourself as much as you want. All we really have is our little lives. The rest of it is just, you know, crap that comes out of our heads on some level. Am I right? So, you know, it's like maybe people are boring when they talk about themselves to you because really either you're too busy thinking about yourself and your own self-importance, or you would rather not talk about you or them at all and just hear the crap that comes out of their head. You see, it's a weird line. I mean, how many people are really altruists, Mark Riley? How many people are really out there in the world only to serve the world and honor the better good? Most people are full of crap.
Wait
and
a
most
minute.
People, what?
Mother Teresa's past, right?
Right. But, I mean, it's just my belief that, you know, a lot of times people will use almost anything, any agenda, any self-righteousness, any supposed virtue, just to avoid themselves, you know, and present themselves as something they really aren't. You know, frightened, whiny, self-pitying little people who, you know, who would rather, you know, hide behind the idea that they're doing something worthy or that they're more important than they really are, as opposed to just, you know, be honest. Like, here's your little life. How does that little life look? Are you happy with it? Is there a narrative there that, you know, is worth sharing? You know, what do you learn in that little life? I've always found that stuff interesting about just about anybody. That's just my personal point of view. And in relationship to my listeners and our listeners, you know, in terms of this person who accuses me of talking too much about myself, we got this email. Hey, Mark, read your playa hater in SF. You can tell her that I, too, used to hate you for all the same reasons. You seem like the annoying guy you'd overhear in the cafe, babbling on, direct from ass to mouth, working on latte number 3. Then, it all changed. I converted. Possible causes. 1, there is some funny-ass stuff on your show. Uh-huh. I realize that you are more qualified than the ass from the cafe. 2, you've probably heard enough about this kind of stuff, so you started working in more attention to liberal issue details. 3, there is no 3, just a summary. This woman, tell her she's absolutely right on all counts. But wait a minute. Yeah, all right. But tell her to keep doing what she's doing. Hang on. Feel the love behind her hating obsession, and one day she'll forgive and learn to like. On that day, life will be better for everyone. Well, for everyone, that's right. For everyone involved. Everyone in the world, if one more person, you know, doesn't become, you know, irritated and annoyed with, that's the weird thing about obsessing, isn't it, Riley? That when you're really locked in, like that guy, man, that guy, I hate that guy. That you know, either there's only 2 things going on: either you just adore them, or you're much like them somehow.
I would agree with that. I mean, what we're talking about here, Mark, is someone who follows, I guess, what both of us say, but certainly what you say, way too close.
Dude, she writes it down. I mean, you know, the only reason I don't play it on the air is because, you know, I don't want to make her some sort of hero. You know, I don't want her to, you know, like, if we could actually use her hate list as a recap of the show, literally. If you missed what we did yesterday, here's a list of exactly a second-by-second thing. It's hilarious. You know what? I'm teasing it. I'm officially teasing it. There will come a time, if we get a good one, if she's, you know, relatively inspired. The funny thing is that, you know, she claims that, you know, that I talk too much about myself. You know, but this person, you know, could not sound more monotone, more uninteresting and boring. It's unbelievable with her lists. I'm excited, and then that's one of the reasons we
played
on
maybe
she perked it up a little bit. We played on the air.
Well, but see, that's now you've invited her to do that. Now she's going to call. She's going to leave another string because she always runs out, you know, of message time on our machine. So we're going to have another. Next message was received at 9:15 a.m. Next message received 9:16 a.m.
Dude, don't you understand? She's just up the narcissistic game. She is checkmated my narcissism with her own. We're sitting here talking about her mundane, obsessive, tedious messages and then sharing it with the entire country. She's done it, man. She's a narcissistic genius. She's turned it around.
Wow.
She's spun it, and we're talking about her without even letting the public hear her. You win, man. You win. Yeah, your unemployment and your self-employment, whatever it is, your insomnia has paid off. It has become clear that you are indeed more narcissistic than I am, and you've just won the game. We will be back with the sound of Scott McClellan addressing a question. This was in November 6, 2003, about this particular case we've been talking about, the POWs who are being denied the money owed to them that was, you know, given to them by a court of law in relation to the Geneva Conventions for torture that they went through at Abu Ghraib during the first Gulf War. And the Bush administration says, no, these are different Iraqis now. We're not going to give you that money. Yet there are military contractors in that country who have done nothing and gotten hundreds of millions of dollars. And when accused of doing nothing, you know, they said, well, you know, the Iraqi government gave it to us. Now, you know, that's a different story. But the truth is in that these POWs are owed this money by the Iraqi government, and this government said, it's a different Iraqi government. We're taking your money. We're taking your money. We're taking the taxpayers' money. We're making budget cuts to take money to funnel it through this reverse money laundering scheme on behalf of the neocon death cult to fill the pockets of price-gouging corrupt military contractors. That's what's going on. It's Air America Radio. It is now 13 past the hour. We'll be back.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Hi.
That is some real rock and roll. Right. Listen to that, huh? I like that guitar sound. Mm. It's weird. It sounds like it's sort of Stoogey sounding, but it's not the Stoogies. Can I just play this, please?
Boy, this is f***ing ponderous, man. Ponderous, f***ing ponderous.
It's definitely ponderous. I mean, good golly, Miss Molly. You know what I'm saying, Riley?
Yeah.
So now, look, coming up, we have Morning Sedition's first ever ticket giveaway. Later in the show, we'll be giving away a pair of tickets to Mark Maron's sold-out show. I'm reading it like I'm like, it's me. Tomorrow night, I'm playing at Symphony Space. I got two sets of tickets. We're going to give one away today, and tomorrow we're going to have a competition, a contest that involves Alf. So how exciting is that? And I just said rock and roll. You know that my buddy Russ Manif does a joke about that. That really shows your age. if you call music like, hey, that's some good rock and roll, it's like there's a generational problem. Not like that rocks. That's good rock and roll music. What am I, 90? What am I, 60? What am I, 50?
Hey, wait a minute.
I'm sorry, buddy. I'm sorry, man. So now we're going to hear. This is Scott McClellan in reference to when this lawsuit was originally settled. Am I right? In reference to the POWs who were, you know, who have won a suit against the Iraqi government, but that was awarded them from an American court in relation to, you know, under the auspices of the Geneva Convention standards that have been set, they were, you know, awarded close to $1 billion.
$653 million in compensatory, $306 million in punitive. This is against the government of Iraq.
Saddam's government.
And by the way, at the time this ruling was made, America already had $1.7 billion, more than enough to pay this claim, in frozen Iraqi assets in its possession.
Right then and there. So now, you know, this is back, you know, these guys want their money, and the administration is saying, no, sorry, this is a different game there now. That money's gone, and the money we do have, we need to put into rebuilding Iraq. We need to take the money that was awarded to you by a court, because they probably think it's some sort of frivolous lawsuit. So they're restricting the victims of torture's rights at behest of a foreign government that we have now, immobilized. And now they're denying these guys because that money needs to go into the pockets of a military contractor.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing. So this is an administration, the neocon death cult, that really cares about the military, really cares about the people of this country, that really just, you know, wants to continue to funnel, you know, the taxpayers' money into this reverse money laundering scheme that they've got going in Iraq that has cost, you know, almost 2,000 Americans their lives, 7 to 10,000 injured, you know, hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians injured. And here domestically, they're going to, you know, cut programs that we'll get into that in a minute. Let's listen to Scott McClellan And what's interesting about his response is that the truth is in there, but he's telling the truth in a way to protect himself and also, you know, pay some sort of weird lip service to the idea that he's being noble and the administration is doing the right thing. But in the text, all he's doing is protecting himself and this administration from being accused of lying, when what they're really saying is, we're going to screw these guys. But they're saying it, you know, in like this. But it'll be nice. It'll be good. It's going to be a just thing, but we're going to screw these guys. Right, Chris?
There are 17 former POWs from the first Gulf War who were tortured and filed suit against the regime of Saddam Hussein, and a judge has ordered that they are entitled to substantial financial damages. What is the administration's position on that? Is it the view of this White House that that money would be better spent rebuilding Iraq rather than going to these former POWs?
I don't know that I view it in those terms, David. I think that the United States, first of all, the United States condemns in the strongest terms the brutal torture to which these Americans were subjected. They bravely and heroically served our nation and made sacrifices during the Gulf War in 1991, and there is simply no amount of money that can truly compensate these brave men and women for the suffering that they went through at the hands of Saddam Hussein's brutal regime. That's what our view is.
But isn't it true that this White House is, this White House is standing in the way of them getting those awards, those financial awards, because it views it that money better spent on rebuilding Iraq?
Now, again, there's simply no amount of money that can truly compensate these brave men and women for the suffering. I'm coming to your question. Believe me, I am. Let me finish. Let me start over again, though. No amount of money can truly compensate these brave men and women for the suffering that they went through at the hands of a very brutal regime, at the hands of Saddam Hussein. It was determined earlier this year by Congress and the administration that those assets were no longer assets of Iraq, but they were resources required for the urgent national security needs of rebuilding Iraq. But again, there's simply no amount of compensation that could ever truly compensate these brave men and women.
Why would you stand in the way of, at least letting them get...
I disagree with the way you characterized it.
The law that Congress passed entitles them to access frozen assets of the former regime, then why isn't that money, per a judge's order, available to these victims?
So I pointed out that was an issue that was addressed earlier this year, but make no mistake about it. We condemn in the strongest possible terms the torture that these brave individuals went through at the hands of Saddam Hussein. There is simply no amount of money that can truly compensate those men and women who heroically served our nation.
Some of the money.
And again, I just said that had been addressed earlier this year.
They're entitled to the money under that law. The question is this administration blocking their effort to access some of that money and why?
I don't view it that way at all. I view it the way that I stated it. This issue was addressed earlier this year, and we believe that there's simply no amount of money that could truly compensate these brave men and women for what they went through, for the suffering that they went through at the hands of Saddam Hussein. And that's my answer.
Yeah, but the court decided there was an amount, and that amount was close to $1 billion for these 17 guys. But listen to what he's saying. Yeah, this guy's an evil prick. Oh, can I say that? Unbelievable that, this closeted douchebag can parse language like that. I mean, it's unbelievable that he can sit there with a straight face and say there is no amount of money, as if he's speaking in code to the people that, all you demons out there that don't want the military, these guys who are true victims of real torture to have their money. Here's the code. There is no amount of money that will ever compensate these brave men and women. But what he's really saying is, we're not going to pay them. And there is an amount, and it was decided by the court that they should get it. But this administration is saying, what they're really saying, and repeatedly, so they can watch their own arses, is that, no, there is no amount, and then they couch it in this language, like, what they've gone through is so awful, really. How can you ever repay them? Well, you could start by giving them the $1 billion that the court has awarded them, from Iraq, and not just, put it into the pocket of Halliburton. You evil bastards.
Well, now let's look at exactly what they're doing and exactly where this suit is. First of all, the suit was thrown out by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. It went there first. Now the lawyers for the POWs have asked the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, to rule on whether the lawsuit has validity. They will be supposedly making a decision about whether to hear the case sometime over the next 2 months or so. But what the Bush administration did here was again, very, very cunning in addition to being evil. What they said was that because an emergency bill that was passed by Congress after the invasion of Iraq approved the expenditure of $80 billion for military operations, a clause in that piece of legislation authorized Bush to suspend the sanctions against Iraq. That, and those sanctions had been in place, of course, since 1991. They said that clause also allowed Bush to remove Iraq from the State Department's list of state sponsors of terrorism, therefore undercutting the claim of the POWs to that $1 billion that they had been awarded.
There's no amount of money that they could possibly, you know, compensate with. So they've made the decision that we are going to give you no money because, really, would money really make a difference?
It makes a difference in terms of people that were abused at Abu Ghraib. Rumsfeld is on the record saying Iraqis should be compensated for abuse.
Of course it'll make a difference. Of course it'll make a difference. I mean, it's due them. I mean, this is like goes right in line with everything that this administration is about. Denying victims their rights, even if it's prisoners of war and the money isn't even from them. Though it is a sort of non-functioning American corporation, Saddam Hussein's government. 866-303-2270. Get ready to tell us your dreams, because that's coming up. We're going to do a little dream interpretation, because we like to. It's fun. 27 past the hour. It's Air America Radio.
Mommy was a hostess. Daddy was a drunk.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Having trouble.
Hey, folks. It is 34 past the hour. Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley there.
Yes, it is.
We are on Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. We're going to be taking calls with dreams, as we like to do, because it's fun. We do that sometimes on this show. We'll just take like a half an hour and have fun. And it's crazy because, you know, we should be talking about the issues. We're fighting for our lives here. But sometimes we take a half an hour just to enjoy ourselves. So if you have a dream you want to share with us, 866-303-2270. We're not professionals. We'll take a shot at it. Here's mine from last night. It's in the future, and I'm 140 years old. I'm on the way from Queens to New Jersey to the hospital where I was born. I'm riding in a rickshaw being pulled by a three-legged Belgian. I do this every 5 years to have my organs replenished. I have a couple of stem cell smoothies, and I'm good to go. Americans in bad shape, though. The Bush family has morphed into a monarchy. George Bush is the fourth on the throne, and he only emerges from the White House for holidays. Of course, he has syphilis, so that makes it harder for him. Jeb Bush is on the $1 million bill, which will buy a newspaper. The sky is a permanent brownish gray, and everyone breathes portable canisters of purified air and, just for laughs, helium. Poor people have become amphibious and live in underwater slums and only come to the surface to eat garbage and french fries made from a huge genetically engineered Idaho potatoes. The streets are mostly deserted because of various plagues caused when the Bush royal family cut funding that would have prevented them. They said it was God's will. The rich have moved out. They live in gated communities on the moon or in the dome state of Idaho, where they grow those freakishly large potatoes. The three-legged Belgian stops the rickshaw at the hospital. My doctor tells me my organ replenishing insurance has been cut off by King George IV. God's will. No stem cell smoothies for Mark. Doc says, but we can put you down here if you like. Nice and easy. I sit down and sigh. You know, things used to be better. He says, I know. You told me 100 times before. People were better. The world was better. I say, people were always lousy. But there was a world once. I was there. I can prove it. When I was a kid, you could buy meat anywhere. Eggs. They had real butter. Not this crap. I woke up, and my bed was filled with Soylent Green. Which is people!
Ooh. Ooh.
All right, buddy. Here we go. Here we go. Let's try to get into this. It always scares me, these dreams, because I'm excited, but you know it's you never know what you're going to get into. Brian, listening in Albany, New York. How are you? What was your dream last? What do you got? What do you got in the dream table?
Hey. Oh my God, it was crazy. I was laying there, and the strange thing about my dreams is I'm always like in a third person watching myself have these dreams, and I got a phone call from one of the Spice Girls.
Wow, the Spice Girls.
Yeah. Weird, right?
Yeah. Which one? Girls.
It was the, what was her name? No. The black one. What was her name?
Scary Spice.
Correct.
Okay, she
Scary
calls you.
She calls me up and invites me to give me backstage passes, and that she's sorry for whatever they did. She never got it to what it was that they did to me.
Wow.
She invited me to a concert they were having here in Albany.
Wow.
So
let me take a shot at it. I think what this is, all right, I think that, now let's try and remember, the Spice Girls were everywhere. They were everywhere. They were all
right.
Over the collective unconscious. You could not
right.
go anywhere without getting, you know, hit in the face by a Spice Girl. All right, so this is part of the past. This is part of something that was, you know, part of your past that you were obsessed with, that completely consumed your life. That's a metaphor.
Might be wrong there.
Huh?
I think you might be wrong there.
I'm not talking about the Spice Girls, but it represents something that you were completely consumed with. And the concert represents you being invited or moving into a more harmonious period in your life. Is that possible?
It's possible. I used to date a girl from England, and I was very, very serious with her.
But does serious mean obsessed and all consumed?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so now maybe you're finally getting over that, and the concert means that you're willing to let that go and move into a sort of a more harmonious point in your life. You're ready to be around other people to maybe start enjoying yourself again.
You are the man, Mark.
Thanks, buddy. Well, good luck with that. Have a good time at the concert.
All right, man.
Okay, take it easy.
I was afraid you were going to say he should go out and stalk her or something.
No, he's past that, man. All right, John, listening in Oregon, you got a dream to share with us, my friend?
I do. This happened last night, and it was really weird, but I was in a warehouse with some people, and all of a sudden, these two bull elephants was outside the building, and people come in running and screaming because they were stampeding people and killing people, and they started ramming the walls, and they were trying to get in to kill everybody.
Oh, my God.
And there was about five of us that decided we had to do something, and everybody had these small, everybody had rifles, but they were all fairly small. I had a 50 caliber rifle, but I only had two shells.
We made
a plan that I'd take one shot to bring them down, and everybody else would come in on them, but in order to do it, I had to get closer, so I had to sneak out closer to them until they got close enough to shoot, and they were ramming, and then I woke up.
Well, I think this is definitely a dream that signals that you should probably be involved in your local Democratic Party.
I think it's guilt. I think it's guilt because I voted for Bush in 2000.
Well, see what happened? Now we've got elephants crushing everything.
But I voted for Kerry in 2004. But
is it the elephant is a symbol of the
Republican Party.
I know.
But you know what I love about that dream, though, dude, is that you know, everybody had these small guns, and I think that's on some level the way a lot of Democrats feel. We're just sort of like, I wish my gun was bigger. You know what I mean?
What it was is if everybody got together, they would be able to take them down. That was the part of the dream.
And I like that you had the biggest gun.
Wow, of course.
So I think that signals that you're going to have to be a leader now. You're going to have to really step up. And obviously, it's a political dream in my mind, don't you think?
We have Lars Larson out here, and I'm constantly calling him and harassing him. And he made a comment. They were talking about HIV testing, and he made a comment saying how the only way you get AIDS is through drug use or prostitutes or having gay sex.
Okay.
And which is, you know.
Wrong.
Wrong.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I've got a friend that I'm constantly, he's on the other side of the fence, and I'm constantly, my goal is to change his mind. That's my goal.
Well, that's it. Okay, well, that's part of the dream, too, man. Thanks for calling. It's good talking to you.
Thanks, John.
Elephants, small guns. Small guns. You know, it's interesting how the language of dreams is always like, you know, there's some things that are just, you know, they're just right there.
But you know what? It sounds like what he's got to do is almost metaphor for what Howard Dean has got to do.
Sure.
Everybody get together, you can take down the big elephant.
Yes. Okay. What do we got here? All right. This could go on a while. This is a frequent caller, and we appreciate his calls, but hopefully we can wrangle it. Brian in Everett, Washington, how are you, man?
Top of the morning, sir.
Hey, Brian.
Let's try and keep this in context.
It was just a short blip because I had in this dream I had a pet pig, right?
Okay.
And the pig, I knew the pig is not eating right because he's getting stuff off the floor and stuff and whatever. And then I'm watching the pig. I'm standing behind the pig and I can see kind of in him, you know.
Yeah.
He's about ready to move his bowels, you know, and out comes a used coffee filter.
Uh huh.
Full of coffee grounds.
Uh-huh.
And I think, oh my God, it's the seventh seal.
The seventh seal of Revelation.
Then my uncle's there, and he's a conservative minister, and he says, well, it should be a legal matter.
Uh huh.
So I don't know.
Oh my God, Brian.
So I got up and had coffee. What can I say? And he threw me to the restroom.
And you began Revelations with your cup of coffee. That's what you did, Brian.
I don't know.
No, the pig is filthy. It symbolizes dirtiness and greediness and stubbornness and selfishness.
Right.
And you were able to see into the pig, and you know, and you knew that he was going to go to the bathroom right there in your apartment, and he was, you know, and it was coffee grounds, and it was the seventh, it was one of the seven seals.
Well, because I think because what happened with me was that I had made this comment to this other local show that the seventh seal is that movement, is that activity.
Is the bowel movement of a pig and delivering you coffee.
It's just my attempt to minimize and demystify this vast panoramic mysticism and just say, well, all it really is just taking a dump.
A pig taking a dump, more specifically, and providing you with the juice that wakes you up in the morning.
Yeah, well, I'm a slob in my apartment, in my house.
I'm sure.
My cat is not getting her moist food. She has plenty of dry food, but I'm out of moist food. I have to go buy her moist food.
Okay, all right, Brian. Well, why don't you get on that and
leave you alone for a while?
Well, no, I'm sure we'll pick this up later in one of the nine messages you'll leave later.
If you have something that needs correcting, I'll call it.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
With Brian, you know, we hear from him a lot. And, you know, there's a fine line between the dream time and the real time. You know what I mean? It's like the shift he made from, like, yeah, the pig was, you know, I could see right in. I had to go to the bathroom. There were coffee grounds. It was the seventh seal of Revelations. And I got to get my cat some food. Right, you know, he's walking in and out of these worlds. We'll be. Let's take one more dream, and then we'll take a break. How are you, Vivian, in Boston?
Hey.
Hi.
What's your dream, Vivian?
I'm a multicultural educator.
Okay.
And I dreamt that there was this group of people around who do anti-racism work.
Uh huh.
And they were doing these workshops around town, and I was part of it.
Uh-huh.
And one of our tasks was we needed to go from one side of this grassy area to the other.
Uh-huh.
But the way to get there was through this big, tall hedge that was like 6 feet tall and really thick. Only there was, if you went along the line of the hedge, there were some areas where you could like kind of squeeze yourself through it.
Through the hedge?
Your breath in, yeah, through the hedge. Only I knew that I needed to be a power of example here.
Yeah.
So I had to go over the hedge in order to show them, you know, the hard way to go,
you
know.
Good for you.
So I, like, climbed up on this prickly hedge, and I was like, oh, my goodness, this feels so horrible, you know. And I realized when I looked over the top of the hedge that there was this big, flat, concrete slab that if I extended my leg over the top of the hedge, I could kind of, like, get right on top of that instead of going, you know, even harder on top of the hedge, laying on top of the hedge.
All right, so there was concrete there to help you out.
Yeah, that's right. So then I get my leg up onto the concrete slab, and I'm standing up on it, and I'm pretty tall up, but I realize I have to jump down now onto the grassy area. So I jump, and there's this woman standing there, and the woman doesn't look like me. She was tall and thin, but she had like caramel color skin and long hair, and I said to her, I'm sorry. I took her hand and I said, I'm sorry. And inside, I knew that I wasn't saying I'm sorry to her for anything I had ever done to her.
Right.
But that I was saying I'm sorry to her for like everything that ever happened to her.
Oh. Well, that's touching. Well, let me work on this. We're going to need a break to do that, Vivian. So hang with us, and I'll see if I can sit down with Riley and figure something
figure
out.
Something, yeah.
Beautiful dream, though. I really enjoyed hearing it. We'll be back in a second at Air America Radio. It's 46 past the hour, 866 303-2270 is the number if you got a dream for us. Call us.
Join the Morning Sedition.
Right now?
Call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Past the hour, Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. We're interpreting dreams, which is a hobby of mine, and every once in a while I get it right. The number is 866-303-2270. We've got time for a couple more. We have Vivian on the phone, whose dream was quite a beautiful lyrical dream where she was with an anti-racism workshop group, and they were crossing a field. They came upon a huge, very tall and thorny hedge that was in their way. She knew that they could squeeze through these cracks if they held their breath and really wedged themselves through to get the other side, but she had to set an example, and she had to overcome the hedge by climbing it. And when she did climb to the top of the hedge, she found that there was a cement platform there, and then she looked down from the platform, and she had to jump down to help a woman that was similar to her, but not her, yet she felt like she wanted to apologize to that woman for all the pain that woman was in, and help her. Is that right, Vivian?
Yeah. It was like kind of like, even though she wasn't someone I knew I had to say I'm sorry to her.
Yeah, you had to apologize to her, right. Well, I think that this dream is very revealing of your character, and if I can try to, be honest about it, I think that, you're obviously on this path with these beliefs you have with this group of people, and you come to this tremendous obstacle, and I think the cracks represent compromise. You could have gone the easy way if you changed your body, changed yourself, changed some of the ways you think and gone through the crack, but instead you chose to set an example, take the higher path, and when you did that, you got to a point that was very firm, very grounded. It was concrete. It couldn't be more grounded personally in your choice to take the higher path and the harder path. And then you look down and realize that, you've got a lot of people to help. You've got a lot of people to make feel better, and you want to make people feel better. And that starts with one person at a time. And you're willing to do that because you're very grounded in your beliefs and feelings around this cause.
Go, Mark.
well, good luck. It was really a beautiful dream. Thanks, Vivian. It
certainly was.
Okay, bye.
Wow. That was pretty good, man.
Thanks, buddy.
You did that in the commercial break?
Yeah. it's touching, man.
You have to do some part-time work after you get out of here every day.
Maybe this is the show I should really be hosting. Steve, listening to Madison, Wisconsin, buddy. What's going on?
How you fellas doing? It's been a while.
Hey,
yeah,
Steve.
Did you call us before?
Oh, yeah. I'm the guy who blamed Tom Petty for the world's problem.
All right, man. All right, what do you got?
Well, here's my deal. I had this dream a few weeks back where I'm here in Madison, Wisconsin, and I was going through one of the Capitol doors, the revolving door we have here at the state Capitol, and I come out the other side, and there's Bill Clinton standing there.
Huh.
All right?
Yeah.
And there he is. He's tall, and he's got all the charisma in the world, and I'm like, hey, Bill, how are you doing? And we're talking politics and stuff. He's like, well, walk with me. Come on, let's walk.
Yeah.
So we're walking down the street, and the cityscape just keeps morphing, At one point it's shops. At one point we're at a residential place. But we're just walking down one street, and, he's got that dignified look on his face, and he's listening to me, and he's got that, how he does that thing with his mouth, I feel your pain.
Yeah.
And I realize I got a book in my hand, and I think to myself, all right, that's probably his book, right? And I look down, and it's Al Franken's book.
Wow.
So I ask him to sign it anyway. And I hand it to him, and I'm like, would you sign this? He's like, looks down at it, and he goes, yeah, I'd sign this book, sure, And he signs it. I'm like, make it for my twin brother, Rob. And that's where the dream ended.
Okay, real quick recap. You go into the Capitol, you come out, you see big Bill Clinton standing there, all Bill Clinton-y. And then you guys start walking down the street. I love when cityscapes change, by the way, in dreams. I love when things morph like that.
Oh, yeah.
So you're walking with Clinton, you realize you got a book under your arm, and then you ask Bill to sign it, and it's Al Franken's book, and he has no problem signing it.
Exactly.
Wow, so let me just ask, we have Bill Clinton here. What do you make of that, Bill?
Well, I think it represents my desire to morph into Al Franken.
Bill Clinton's willing to do just about anything now to stay in the limelight.
Well, you know, I hang around here all morning every day until you put me on the air. Thank God this guy called so I could get some airtime.
Well, so thanks for your call.
See you guys.
So, Bill, maybe you should just hang around till the Franken show and then tell him about this guy's dream. And
Franken won't take my calls.
All right. I need a coffee. Could you get me a coffee?
You need a cruller?
Yeah, cruller would be good. Get yourself something. Here, I'll give you a couple bucks.
What kind of coffee?
Just from the Starbucks or whatever downstairs, just some milk.
Do you need me to sign anything?
Sure, Bill, you can sign the coffee when you come back up.
I'll sign your book. I like that.
Okay, I'll bring my book, too.
All right.
This is getting sad.
I'll go get your coffee.
Well, thanks. You look great, by the way.
Yeah, well, let's just say I'm working out.
Okay, buddy. That's Bill Clinton. Nice of him to stop by and help out with the dream interpretation. Just milk. Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Where? Who?
Riley, nothing.
No.
All right, coming up in the next hour, we're going to have our first ever Mornings Edition ticket giveaway contest. We'll be giving out two tickets to my show tomorrow night at Symphony Space here in New York. We've come up with a special game, and there, you know, a little, you know, some radio fun, right, Riley?
Yes.
Isn't that what people do on the radio? They have fun.
They have fun, and, you know, every now and then they get a little something.
I tell you, man, I was truly touched by that woman's dream. Isn't that why?
It's one of those dreams that you have, and it'll probably stay with her for a good long. I forget dreams after a while, but when you have that kind of complexity and texture to a dream, it stays.
I had a strange meat slicing dream the other night over the weekend. Yeah, it was weird. Where I was slicing meat in a factory, but not a meat factory. It looked more like a drill place, a place where they have drills, like a giant hangar where they just had all kind of random machines. And I'm slicing meat, and one of these factory workers comes up to me and goes, "You know, you're cutting it wrong. It's shredding. You got to go against the grain." And then I started cutting it against the grain, and it came out slices of brain.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Ooh, Wrigley.
Yeah. Yeah, it was good. It was good. It's a little more complicated than that, but we've had enough of me.
Yeah, right? So we've got the iNews 5000. We got the contest. We got a whole bunch of stuff coming up here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
That's right, it's 6 past the hour. The show is Morning Sedition. The network is Air America Radio. The facts, the fury, the funny. Morning Sedition, don't be stupid. Or it feels like thinking. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark Maron.
Oh, my God, what have I done? Brendan P.W. McDonald replacing Kalo for a bathroom break. Forever.
Oh, wow. You booted him, huh?
Kalo's just like, I've had enough of this vegetarian crap.
Kalo bounced? Is that it?
I don't know. He'll be back.
No, he'll
be back. What is going on with that? What did you just say about those two reporters, Judith Miller and the other guy?
Matthew Cooper from Time Magazine.
Because I saw them on Lou Dobbs. Occasionally I watch Lou Dobbs while I eat, which is hard. Because, you know, if I'm watching Lou Dobbs while I'm eating, at some point I'll be like, are there immigrants in my food as well? Because Lou Dobbs is like, be careful, there are immigrants in what you're eating. They're all over the place, people. Wake up, America. But no, I saw Judith Miller on the show last night.
Yeah.
And apparently that they're going to do some jail time. Is that what's going on with that?
Well, they can be jailed and should be jailed, according to a 3-judge federal panel in Washington, for refusing to name their sources in an investigation of the Valerie Plame affair.
But this could lead to a changing of that rule. I mean, isn't that something that journalists are, that is about journalistic integrity?
It is supposed to be about journalistic integrity. The irony here is that Judith Miller never wrote a single article about the disclosure of Valerie Plame's name. Now, Valerie Plame is the wife, we've had him on before,
sure, Joe Wilson,
his wife, CIA operative, whose name was leaked, Robert Novak printed her name.
Yep.
They've been doing an ongoing grand jury investigation since. I don't know that Novak, who actually wrote the thing and disclosed the woman's name, has been subject to the same kind of scrutiny or the same kinds of questions or that certainly not the same sanctions as Judith Miller and Matthew Cooper are, but they are going to end up going to jail, and in Miller's case, it's for an article she never even wrote.
You know, I got it. I have this fascination now lately because I've been talking to Larson about it, Clutch Larson. I want to be a little more journalistic. I want to learn how to do it.
You want to get locked up?
Yeah, no, I don't want to be locked up. Why wouldn't I be locked up than writing about it? You know, but it's like I never learned a lot of basic things, Riley. You know, I mean, like with journalism, it's who, what, where, when, why. Right? Is that it? Who, what, where, when, why?
If it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah.
But
it's so weird, like, because, you know, sometimes I hear you talk about it. I've heard Clutch Larson talk about it, like the whole idea of breaking a story and, you know, the thrill of, like, you know, having it first. It's like,
oh, yeah.
You know, most of that excitement goes around, like, you know, I'm going to get ice cream later. And, you know what I mean? I don't. what's for lunch? And, you know, I get excited about, you know, new jokes and, you know, when something really blows my mind. But I'd like to feel some of that juice. You know, I'd like to learn how to do some reporting. That would be very exciting for me.
Well, this is a situation where these two reporters say that the Shield Law is supposed to protect them from having to reveal their sources to a grand jury. For whatever sets of reasons, the courts are now saying, no, it doesn't hold in this particular case. In fact, the three-judge federal panel cited a Supreme Court decision, Brandsburg versus Hayes, in which a reporter was ordered to testify about witnessing the production of illegal drugs. The panel said the Supreme Court's, quote, transparent and forceful, unquote, reasoning applied to the two reporters that were appearing before the court. And my guess is they're both going to end up going to jail.
We talk about such intense, interesting stuff here every day. You know, I started thinking about, like, you know, like a lot of people don't know about Air America, which bothers me. Because sometimes you go out into the street and, you know, you talk to people. I mean, I'm not just talking about walking up to people on the street going, hey, dude, do you listen to Air America? But even in conversation, like, you know, we're out in a lot of cities, like, you know, 46-plus stations. We just went into L.A. last week. And a lot of people don't know about Air America, and a lot of people don't listen to Air America. And then I thought, like, you know, then I started thinking about the number of people in my life that I know that really don't know or care anything about politics in general. You know, and then they don't even, you know, it doesn't even register on their radar. You know, after the election, you know, there was a lot of people that got worked up, that got focused, that got, you know, active, and they did what they had to do, and they voted properly, and they did whatever they could leading up to the election. But now that the election, it's sort of that political interest is sort of like, oh, boy. I know there's still war, and, you know, the president's bad, but, you know, I got an iPod, and, you know, but... And I spent most of the day, you know, connecting my iPod. Then I read this thing today that 60% of people get more of their news from local TV than from any other single source, all right? Recent research has revealed that the majority of local evening newscasts are completely, almost completely neglectful of local political races and issues. And, you know, 11 of the largest TV markets devoted 8 times more coverage to stories about accidental injuries than local politics. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm guilty of it. You know, before I started, you know, really doing the fine-tooth work that we do here, I mean, politics was like I could speak in broad strokes about it, which is what most people do, but it's not part of, you know, everybody's, you know, everyday waking moment in life.
Well, it really is about the acquisition, manipulation, and maintenance of power.
Mm-hmm.
And once you understand exactly what that means, then for me, politics became fascinating. When I realized that someone could stop a person, for example, from opening a sidewalk cafe, politically. And if you read about any of the history of New York City in particular, guys like Boss Tweed and Jimmy Walker, and the way these people wielded power throughout the history, certainly, of this city. Then you start understanding, for me, politics became a fascinating thing. I became almost like a voyeur, particularly of local politics here in New York.
I find it fascinating and frustrating because people use legislation to maneuver that power and limit people's power and all that stuff. Because that's the other element of when I was talking about our unemployed insomniac in San Francisco, the self-employed insomniac who is obsessed with me and my narcissism. Like, there's another reason why people, you know, have contempt, obsessive contempt for other people. Either they're just like that person and don't want to admit it, or they're in love with that person, or they think that that person is stopping them from doing something, that that person has power over them, or that that person is morally corrupt somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fairly justified reason for not liking somebody. But yeah, okay. On some level, because at least it is founded in something that isn't completely selfish if it is founded in, you know, a true sense of ethics and morality. All right, so now what we're going to do here in the next hour is we're going to have our first first ever Morning Sedition ticket giveaway contest. And we're giving away tickets to my Symphony Space performance tomorrow night, which I believe will be pretty good. I'm feeling pretty strong. You know, I'm still, you know, I'm thinking out my trajectories. We'll be giving out two tickets to the show tomorrow night, Symphony Space, and we've come up with a special game to play to give those tickets away. So here's how it's going to go. We don't have a rock block here, obviously, because we don't do that type of radio. All right, we don't have this sort of little sort of montage of mystery songs. Instead, we have a sentence using clips from four different newsmakers that any regular listener should be familiar with. You know, and these are people, especially if you're, you know, when the political heads.
Yeah.
If you can correctly name all four people in order that are heard in this soundbite, you know, where do I have the soundbite? Here it is, right here. Here it is. You ready?
As virtually everyone agrees, torture has taken place
in the White House,
and we're doing a pretty good job.
Okay, then you win two free tickets to see my sold-out performance at Symphony Space in New York City tomorrow night. Okay, I'll give you one hint. They're all Republicans. All right, here you go.
As virtually everyone agrees, torture has taken place
in the White House,
and we're doing a pretty good job.
The phone lines are open, so you can give us a call at 866-303-2270. The first caller to correctly identify all four Republicans in order that you heard in this clip.
As virtually everyone agrees, torture has taken place
in the White House,
and we're doing a pretty good job.
You can get tickets to see me tomorrow night if that's something you'd like to be involved with. One more time.
As virtually everyone agrees, torture has taken place
in the White House,
and we're doing a pretty good job.
866-303-2270. We'll talk to you when we get back. It's 14 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition. We can't do it without you. Call 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Okay, we got phone calls lined up for a big contest, 866-303-2270. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey!
It's 19 past the hour. It's Air America Radio. I'm going to give you that montage again. If you name who this, all these are in order in the right way, you get two tickets to come to Symphony Space to my show tomorrow night.
As virtually everyone agrees, torture has taken place
in the White House,
and we're doing a pretty good job.
Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So I just bought a brand new iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank it up. Let's get this thing going. Okay, from the New York Times, FDA to create advisory board on drug safety. Here you go, machine. FDA to create advisory board on drug safety. Translation, FDA combats drug fatalities with added layer of bureaucracy. Not bad. Not bad. Here we go. From Fox News, conservatives laud swift boat veterans. Yeah, eat this, machine. Conservatives laud swift boat veterans. Translation, kooks wreck democracy, receive medal. No, that's not bad. Here's one from the Associated Press. Woman, 79, charged with using cane on cops. Eat that, machine. All right. Women 79 charged with using cane on cops. A translation. SWAT team takes down woman 79 after tense 12-hour standoff. With the cane. Oh, with the cane. So I'm going to play this one more time, and so we're going to start taking calls for our contest.
As virtually everyone agrees, torture has taken place
in the White House,
and we're doing a pretty good job.
Okay, here we go. Jim in Connecticut, what do you got?
I got it as Paul, Cheney, Rice, and Bush.
Nope. Sorry, buddy. Thanks for calling. It's okay. It's all right. You know, it happens. You can't be right all the time. Alice in Westchester, what do you got?
Scott McLean, Condi, and Bush.
What was the first one?
Cheney. And Scott McLean.
No, ma'am. Sorry. Good try. Sorry. I'm enjoying the sounds of disappointment.
Ooh. Ow.
Okay, Bill, listening in Nyack.
Wolf Blitzer, Britt Hume, Ann Coulter, President Bush.
No, sir. Sorry.
Well,
good try. All right.
Wow, he beeped himself.
All right, good. Lorraine in Westchester, what do you got?
J.
Cheney Rumsfeld Rice Bush.
Oh, close, but no.
Okay.
That's okay. I'm feeling sad now. Jim in New Jersey, what do you got?
Hey, Mark, hey. I got it, man.
What do you got?
It's Dick, President Cheney, Rummy Rumsfeld, Laura Tootsie Bush, and George Elmer Fudd Bush.
Yes!
Yay! Yeah! Jim, listening to WLIV in New Jersey, you get two tickets to see me tomorrow night.
Sweet.
It'll be fun, man.
I can't wait, man.
Oh, good, good, good. I'm glad. I'm glad you won. Well, I'm sad that the other people lost, but, you know, I'm glad that you're excited. And stay on the line, and we'll give you the information. Thanks a lot, Jim.
Yeah, sure, man. It just freaks me out that I know all those Republican voices.
I know. You do listen. You must listen quite a bit. I mean, that was really, some of those were difficult.
Yeah, I got it right away, man. That's the thing that freaks me out.
Uh-oh.
You know what, Jim? It should freak you out.
All right,
buddy. Wow.
Wow.
I don't know if I would have gotten that. This isn't anything.
As virtually everyone agrees, torture has taken place
in the White House,
and we're doing a pretty good job.
Well, now that I know the answer, and I'm like, oh yeah, I can definitely see that. So Jim's going to come down to Symphony Space. That'll be good, man.
Yeah, yeah. Congratulations.
So I just got to figure out what I'm going to do there.
Engage Jim, perhaps?
Yeah, I'll just talk to Jim. Hey, dude. So you were listening to the show the other day. Wasn't that cool? What we were talking about before. So coming up in the next hour, this should be interesting. These women have written this book called The Career Mystique, Cracks in the American Dream. It's Philip Moen and Patricia Rowling, and it's really about how our belief in the myth of career, that the idea that working hard and paying your dues and will pay off, you know what I mean, and will take care of you.
It won't?
Well, yeah, apparently not, Riley. I mean, judging by everything we've ever talked about on this show, that, you know, the one thing is, it's like that woman who was at President Bush asking that question when he said, when she said, I work three jobs. And he said, well, that's
uniquely American.
Yeah, and it's awful. And I think they're really going to talk about this idea that, you know, there are still people that sort of, I think, cling to that myth, you know, because what else are they going to do? And hopefully they'll shed some light on, you know, some other options, some other ideas for, you know, how to reconstruct the American workplace, you know, in order to more fit the type of lives we lead and to a more just working environment. It should be very interesting.
No, it should be interesting. I have my own theory about this whole work-career kind of thing, because I think that we end up pointing, particularly young people, toward work. First of all, using education essentially to say, well, you're being educated so you can get a job, so you can have a career. Mm. And maybe that's where you have to start. But we'll find out. When we talk,
I don't know. You know, it's weird with me. Like, I never, you know, I worked in restaurants and until recently. I mean, even in talking about, you know, what Social Security. I mean, you know, I was a comic for years. I mean, that was the life I had chosen. You know, I got no kids. You know, I lived the life of a gypsy. I know that for years that I didn't live the life that anybody else, you know, well, most people don't lead the life I led. But I never thought about it. I never, you know, I mean, health coverage was this thing which, like, you know, when I first got it because of, some TV money or whatever, I was excited. But I just, it's only recently that I've really started to sort of get afraid, you know. Because, you know, I look at my old man, you know, and he's like, you know, he's freaking out. He's in his 60s.
Yeah.
You know, he relies on Social Security. I'm thinking, like, you know, you don't know what the hell's going to happen. You can put all your money away today and it could all be gone. Or you could have no money at all and you could wake up and just be in debt hundreds and thousands of dollars.
Well, many, many people. Remember that there was that study about bankruptcies and how many of them were caused by medical bills that people couldn't pay, and it wasn't the people living in poverty weren't the ones ending up bankrupt. In many cases, they were people who had health coverage.
Who had health coverage, but the health coverage wouldn't pay for them dying.
Exactly.
You see, the health coverage is only good if you're not dying. Oh, no, that's too serious. We're not going to pay for that.
Well, you got a guy sitting somewhere in a room or an office or maybe even in a cubicle with a computer there, and they decide what kind of health, illnesses that they will pay for, whether you have to stay a certain amount of time in the hospital, how many doctor visits you're allowed to get. All of these things are decided by actuaries or somebody.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that they don't support, you know, legalized suicide. You would think that they'd have an easy out option. You know, once that they've tapped you of everything and your terminal illness, you know, no longer will, you know, they don't, you no longer have money or any resources to pay for your treatment. It's sort of like, well, we got an idea.
Well,
time
to
go.
That'll be Bill Frist in 08. After all, is a doctor.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's the one that wants to be the next president after Bush. There is a point at which this kind of treatment of people, and again, you see this running the gamut, whether it's the POWs that are suing, whether it's veterans that have to pay $250 just to get access to health care.
Unbelievable.
All of these things paint the same ugly picture.
Yeah, it's easier to die.
Yeah.
Hey, that's upbeat. We'll be back. What do we got coming up there, Riley?
Well, we're going to talk about careers. We're going to talk about the workplace, the work ethic, and the
work
reason
environment
for doing it. When we come back.
With War on Brains, too.
The War on Brains.
Yes.
Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Are you?
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley. There.
Hey.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. The facts, the fury, the funny. Morning Sedition. Don't be stupid. It feels like thinking. Congratulations, Jim in New Jersey, for getting tickets to me. I hope it works out. Right now, don't say anything. I don't want to hear about it. Maybe you can say something after, but not until you're done with your bit. Every week we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the four-year global...
Wow.
Every week we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the four-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. Here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent Morg Milfington.
Thank you, Fraser Smith. Dateline, Boston, Massachusetts, known around the world as the Athens of America and the cradle of liberty. But to me, it'll always be that hilarious place where 21 people drowned in 2 million gallons of molasses.
What?
It's deja poo all over again, America, as we wake up to find the fiendishly intoxicated Bush administration hovering over the great cosmic urinal, making water upon humankind's greatest asset, the brain. That sacred hub of all intellect, the crucible of reason, and the universe's only known source for lame one-person shows based on the differences between men and women.
I know that one.
This latest assault was staged utilizing the most insidious weapon to date in the neoconservatives' arsenal, the Bush 2006 budget. A budget that will, among other things, slash America's lead hazard reduction program by $48 million. Plumbum.
What?
You heard me. I'll say it again. Plumbum. The root of the word plumbing. And as you know, Mark, the Latin word for lead. In ancient Rome did the Emperor Caligula a stately pleasure dome decree. Its pipes made from the finest lead, lead cups, lead pots, plates, pans, lead seasoned food, and lead chastity belts. And in the fifth year of his reign did the Roman Senate pass the Clear Skies Initiative, heralding the fall of the Great Republic. For according to a new study performed at the Harvard School of Public Health in Boston, even the lowest level exposure to lead over long periods of time can lead to severe mental bad things happening your thoughts too. Shameful, minious. Igno shameful. Other symptoms include a steep decline over time in mental acuity. Whatever that means. I don't even understand what the hell that sentence means, Mark. Do you? Other symptoms include a steep decline over time in mental acuity?
Mort, I think it just means other symptoms include a steep decline over time in mental acuity. It's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Woo! You lost me, Mark. Way over my head, brainiac.
Hey, Mort, buddy, is there any chance you've been exposing yourself to low levels of lead over long periods of time?
Mark, the manner in which I manufacture and apply my face powders, rouges, and mascaras is none of your business. All I can say is you don't get beautiful alabaster cheeks and playfully red accents by diet and exercise alone.
Okay, all right. Look, are there any other signs of lead poisoning, like memory loss? Or...
You have any questions, Mark? Perhaps having to do with other signs of lead poisoning, like memory loss?
Mort,
What's going to happen to America?
Americans are doomed to suffer the same fate as Gaius Caligula, living a life of unbridled drunkenness and gluttony, eating sautéed truffles from baskets made of hummingbird tongues, and having sex with your hot stepsisters.
Oh, God.
Yeah, sounds great. But while you're doing all this, odds are you'll have gout, dropsy, and be a cretin. You won't remember any of it anyway, so in my opinion, it's six of one, half dozen of the other. So until next time, you paint-eating degenerates, fill up your tank with ethyl and unlock those chastity belts, because we're going to have a big Caligula party.
Yeah.
And that's today's dispatch from...
Thank you, Mort. Always very exciting, enlightening. It was nice to try to help you out there.
By the way, third caller gets to watch me write my set for my next open mic gig at Stiffy's in Stockton. Should be a big thrill for the winner.
You're going to be opening for Rob Becker?
Rob Becker, that's right. The caveman defending him.
Oh,
big difference between men and women.
There is.
Don't forget that.
Yeah, and why don't you make some notes about that? I bet you have some stuff.
I will.
Right,
got them right here. Third caller. Dan Pashman here. Dan Pashman, 89 by the hour.
Yahtzee. Thanks, Mort. You're channeling Pashman. And he's right in there. He's looking weird and depleted. His eyes are rolling back in his head. How
Dan
do you do
Pashman
that?
Coming up with the weather. I feel hot about it.
Mort Milfie's been doing Dan Pashman.
Oh, I have definite opinions. I'm Dan Pashman.
All right, buddy.
Where is this coming from?
I think I got some people on the phone I got to talk to.
All right, see you later. Well,
all right, yeah, okay. Thanks. All right.
Wow.
Can we regroup a little bit?
Only slightly.
Thanks, Mort. The book, The Career Mystique, Cracks in the American Dream, deals with how people are still sort of under this illusion that hard work will pay off and take care of them. Obviously, there's many reasons why that isn't true. On the phone, we have the co-authors of The Career Mystique. We have Phyllis Moen and we have Patricia Rowling, both professors. Phyllis is the McKnight Presidential Chair of Sociology at the University of Minnesota. And Pat is the chair of the psychology department at Hope College in Holland, Michigan. And they are both on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, professors, why don't we start by saying what is the career mystique?
Well, this is Phyllis. Can we back up and talk about the feminine mystique for a minute?
Absolutely.
The feminine mystique, Betty Friedan coined that term in the 1960s, which to capture the cultural contradictions of expecting that women's total fulfillment could come from full-time homemaking.
Mm-hmm.
What she didn't look at was the mirror image, the career mystique, that is really the notion that men's total fulfillment should come from full-time, continuous investment in their jobs throughout most all of their adulthood.
Okay.
And we coined this term to capture not only the other side of the feminine mystique, but also to recognize that now both men and women are following the career mystique and that it's not working.
And why isn't that working, especially with this administration and obviously with policies that make it impossible for people to earn a living or get health protection or get many of the basic things that we need in life? What are some of those elements that are causing it not to work and causing it to break down?
You're exactly right that it isn't working because all of the policies that we have really were based on the breadwinner homemaker model, assuming that workers could devote all their time to their jobs because they had backup on the home front. Now, very few workers, men or women, have someone at home to take care of the domestic responsibilities.
Professor Rowling, I get the sense, though, that most Americans would believe that old model was smashed some years ago. Yet, I guess your book is arguing that it never really changed that much.
Well, which model are you talking about?
The model of the homemaker and the working husband.
Well, what has happened is that was the traditional model, but now what we've got is something more like we call a neo-traditional model, and that is that
women are not saying, well, some women still say that being home full time is the, you know, ultimate fulfillment for themselves, but many women also want to be fulfilled by a career.
Okay, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so women are now putting themselves into the workplace. They're trying to buy into this career mystique. And, you know, the majority of women are working. Even women with infants in the home are working. And so we find now that these women also want the success. They're devoting themselves to their careers, but they're finding that they can't do both. They can't be the kind of parent they want to be. They can't be the kind of worker they want to be. And men are finding the same thing also. So we really don't have the same type of gender divide. Now we have women more scaling back to make home more manageable, but yet they still feel like they want to try to fit in and chase this career mystique.
Well, let's talk about this administration and these Republicans who claim to be, you know, the party of the family. It seems to me that, you know, as it takes more to earn more, and a lot of these jobs that I imagine we're referring to, you know, no longer even exist. I mean, what kind of policies are in place now that are really, these are eroding the family and making it impossible for families to stay intact, aren't they?
Yes, we talked about the work-family mismatch, the fact that now all adults in the household are increasingly at jobs. So that's one mismatch that policies are not addressing. Another is the lockstep mismatch, the assumption that people want to move from continuous employment to continuous full-time retirement with no way of phasing in or moving back and forth. A third mismatch, and it's very important in terms of a policy perspective, is the risk safety net mismatch. No longer does seniority buy anyone job security. Probably Pat and I, as tenured professors, have the last good jobs in terms of a secure job. Most people, even those who follow the lockstep pattern of the career mystique, find themselves often at age 50, right when their kids are going to college, suddenly asked to retire early or else be downsized.
So now let's talk, professors, about how do things have to change to make the family healthier, to make the time more efficient, and to make the workspace and the job more productive on the levels that we're talking about.
Well, one thing that has to change is we have to have more flexible ideas of what a full-time work week is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we define it, government institutions and workplaces define it as 40-plus hours a week. And, you know, we need to look at what really would make sense for people. In Europe, the full-time work week is, 35 to 40 hours a week. And they manage to have productive economies with good employment. And that's something that would, I think, help families today manage their lives better to say, full-time is a 38-hour work week. 35-hour work week per couple would give people 10 more hours a week to devote to family, to community, to other interests.
But the clockwork of jobs, if you think about this glass matrix of nested clockworks, the work hour, the work day, the work week, mm-hmm. the work life,
mm-hmm.
all of these are so much part of our economy that we don't see them, that jobs come prepackaged. It's interesting, my undergraduates, when I ask them how they're going to manage their lives, they say, when we have children, both spouses will work part-time. They don't realize that everything assumes a full-time worker, so you don't get health insurance. You don't get pension, putting money into pensions. You don't get any kind of high salary if you're both working part-time, and you're effectively eliminated from ever progressing up any kind of ladder.
Well, Professor Moen, Professor Rowling, thank you for joining us. We have the book here. The book is The Career Mystique, Cracks in the American Dream. It will be available on morningsedition.com for a discount. We have a lot of work to do, apparently. It's 47 past the hour. Thank you, ladies, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good morning. We'll be back in a moment with a few more things. Hey, Mark Riley?
There you go.
Okay. We are going to leave now and come back.
Hi, this is Reverend Barry Lynn from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. If you want to get the truth about the Bush administration's ongoing battle against science and reason, tune into the War on Brains with Mort Milfington on Morning Sedition, Air America Radio.
We're going to now take the large Morning Sedition airplane and land it on that big gaping runway. That's right. We're going to put this thing down. Do you understand, San Francisco? We're coming in for landing. It's 52 past the hour, Mark Riley.
Hey.
That's an inside joke that only one person will get. But that goes out to her. All right. Anyways, here we go, buddy. So let's get back into this Ibrahim Al-Jafari for the last few minutes of our show. The representative of the Dawa Party,
yes,
which is one of two parties within the United Iraqi Alliance. We have the Dawa Party and the Skiwi.
The Skiris.
What is it?
Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq.
That sounds heavy, dude.
It is heavy.
All right.
I mean, these are the winners. To the victors belong the spoils. So what they managed to do was to get the Dawas and the Skiris together. The Skiris had a candidate that they wanted to see installed as prime minister. What they did was sit down, work out their problems, and decided to support Jafari and Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, the unseen hand who's manipulating all of this stuff, says he will sign off on Jafari becoming Iraq's next prime minister.
Well, this guy Jafari seems malleable. He seems, certainly, Muslim enough in terms of what he's willing to do. He is, it's not real clear where he stands on theocracy, but clearly, he wants Iraq to be led under some form of Sharia, under some form of Islamic law. He does not present himself as a extremely religious person, per se.
No, but here's a quote from him directly, and this is in an Associated Press interview. Ibrahim al-Jafari says, quote, Islam should be the official religion of the country and one of the main sources for legislation, along with other sources that do not harm Muslim sensibilities.
Right. He also says, quote, a man is worth two women, unquote. What?
So, is that on the open market?
No, I think it's in the Quran, my friend.
Oh, okay.
Quote, we have to be careful about taking verses in isolation, unquote. So he does it and then he doesn't do it. But, the scary thing about this guy is he just could be the more sort of gentle, urbane face of what could become a fairly radical theocracy.
He could be, but it seems as though they, and when I say they, I'm talking about the United Iraqi Alliance, they seem to be taking great pains to say, we're not going to be exactly the same as the Iranians. We are not going to install a hardline, Sharia-based, Muslim, Shiite theocracy, which is what they have in Iran.
Well, yeah, but what you were saying, though, Jafari wanting to keep the Americans there as long as possible,
yes,
to stave off any sort of counterattack, any sort of civil war, any sort of my concern is that he's just paying a lot of lip service to whatever is necessary in order to get the roots of some sort of Islamo-fascist front occurring.
That is a possibility here, but it is a possibility born of America's haste in invading Iraq in the first place. This is,
yes,
what you get. As Colin Powell said, you break the pottery, you own it. Well, this, whatever happens out of this, whether it's Jafari or Shalabi, who's not done yet, he's still lobbying, still trying to negotiate to be Iraq's prime minister.
Right.
Now, he is, of course, a, quote, secular. He promises a secular government.
Yeah.
The real question is how federalist this government is. How much autonomy are they going to give to the different regions within the country as opposed to coming straight out of a central Islamic government?
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly what you said, Mark Riley. And he said it well. There's our liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Here are marching orders. Write this down. One, read Jose Canseco's book. Then, regardless of your profession, enhance your performance with steroids. You hear me? Two, language change. Refer to being picked up by a gay prostitute as being gannonized or gannoned or on the gan. Three, point to the fact that the NHL hockey season may be canceled as a victory for the peace movement. Four, go to Michael Jackson trial, gather all his celebrity character witnesses together, and have a MoveOn.org fundraiser. And five, today's phrase, just drop it in the conversation. Oh, yeah, Bush is right. Congress should definitely renew the Patriot Act. Got to keep our kids safe from books, man. Wake up, sheeple. Bush is coming at you with a taser. Don't drink the Kool-Aid, man. I had two tastes of this coffee. My brain is sliding in my head.
Uh-oh, don't worry about it. We are off the air.
I'm jangled.
Just about. But okay. Tomorrow, one of our friends, Mick Ware, joins us.
Yes.
Time Magazine's Baghdad Bureau Chief. He's going to be in Beirut to talk about Syria when we come back to you tomorrow morning here on Air America Radio. Have a good one, Marin.
You too, Riley.
Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.